Let me try to get a commitment out of you to do something, if you would. Between now and April 25th, All for Jesus Sunday, if you would also get out the church phone list and go down the names there, and anybody that you see a name that you haven't seen in church for a while, give them a call. They expect me to, and I do, but they kind of expect that. But if somebody else called and said, you know, we miss you, we'd love to see you, and how about trying to come out for that day? It would be an encouragement to them. And again, if you bathe it in prayer before you call, it's amazing to me how ready some Christians are to get on the phone to call somebody to complain, but how they forget to call somebody to encourage. And so just call them up and let them know you missed them and tell them that you'd love to see them and just see if you can get a commitment from them to come. And it'd go a long way. It doesn't even require getting in the car or anything else, just getting on the phone. Hebrews chapter 12, the Bible's upside down. Hebrews chapter 12, starting where we left off last time, in verse number 6. Well, actually, let's start in verse number 4. Ye have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. And ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. If ye endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? But if ye be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are ye bastards, and not sons. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, if you're lucky, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. Now no chastening for the present seemed to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. Wherefore, lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way. But let it rather be healed. Now, give the lesson tonight. By the way, this is the 26th lesson in Hebrews so far. And like I said, not every one of those lessons took one night, but classifying the lessons according to the subjects that we've seen, 26 different lessons that I've enumerated. And I titled this one, Called In from the Playground. And did you ever get called in from the playground? You know, I mean, mom called you in, you know, or dad called you in. I can remember a particular instance. I don't remember what it was I did. But I remember my mom on my bicycle chasing me with my father's razor strap down the street. And just laying it on me as I was... But she came after me. I did something, and she came to the place where I was on my bicycle. And I mean, it was just like some kind of medieval thing, you know. Right in front of my friends. It was the most embarrassing probably thing ever happened in my life at that point. But just wappa, wappa, wappa all the way home. But you've been called in. And that reminded me of something I remember Tozer writing, and so I looked it up. And a couple of paragraphs here. It's not that long, but it's because it's Tozer, it's worth spending some time in. And he wrote several books, but wrote a book called God Tells the Man Who Cares, and there's a chapter in there called This World, Battleground or Playground. And here's what he said, and just again, this is not the whole chapter, but I went back as far as I felt like I needed to in order to have you make sense of the part I really wanted to read. He says, one of the most popular current errors, and the one out of which springs most of the noisy, blustering religious activity being carried on in evangelical circles these days, by the way, even in the 1950s when he was still alive, they used the word evangelical and fundamentalist pretty interchangeably, so don't think he's pointing fingers at everybody but us, because we would have been included in that term in the 50s. Anyway, the blustering religious activity being carried on in evangelical circles these days is the notion that as times change, the church must change with them. Christians must adapt their methods by the demands of the people. If they want 10-minute sermons, give them 10-minute sermons. If they want truth in capsule form, give it to them. If they want pictures, give them plenty of pictures. If they like stories, tell them stories. If they prefer to observe the religious instruction through the drama, go along with them. Give them what they want. The message is the same, only the method changes, say the advocates of compromise. Isn't it amazing that he said this a half a century ago? Whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad, the old Greek said. And they were wiser than they knew. That mentality which mistakes Sodom for Jerusalem and Hollywood for the holy city is too gravely astray to be explained otherwise than as a judicial madness visited upon professing Christians for affronts committed against the Spirit of God. Be ever hearing, but never understanding. Be ever seeing, but not perceiving. Make the heart of this people gross. Make their ears dull and close their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their hearts and turn and be converted. But some earnest persons reason, since there is no stillness in this mechanized world, we must learn to get along without it. We cannot hope to bring back the still waters and the quiet pastures where David once led his sheep. This rat race of civilization is too noisy for us to hear the still small voice. So we must learn to hear God speak in the earthquake and the storm. And if modern evangelism is geared to the tumult and the agitation of the times, why should anyone complain? Does it not represent an honest effort to be all things to all men, that by any means some should be saved? The answer is that the soul of man does not change fundamentally, no matter how his external conditions may change. The aborigine in his hut, the college professor in his study, the truck driver in the bedlam of city traffic have all the same basic need: to be rid of their sins, to obtain eternal life, and to be brought into communion with God. Civilized noises and activities are surface phenomena, a temporary rash on the epidermis of the human race. To attribute sound values to them and then to try to bring religion into harmony with them is to commit a moral blunder so huge as to stagger the imagination, and one for which we shall surely be paying long after this frenetic extravaganza we call civilization has ended in tragedy and everlasting grief. What certain religious teachers fail to understand is that true Christian experience takes place in the human spirit, far in and beneath the changing surface of things. It is only the surface that responds to noise and agitation. The deep in part of the man lies in primeval silence, waiting that quickening word that shall give it second birth. Because this far in spirit of the man is separated from God, the whole life is out of order. So the flesh and the imagination take over and direct the thinking, the willing and the doing of the individual man and the race of which he is a part. These create the dance macabre, the dance of death we know as society, and in which as natural men we find ourselves. So popular Christianity parrots the language of the New Testament theology, but it accepts the world's opinion of itself and sedulously apes its ways. That is, the church accepts the world's opinion of the world, not the world's opinion of the church. Let me repeat that. Popular Christianity parrots the language of New Testament theology, but it accepts the world's opinion of itself and sedulously apes its ways, except for a few evil practices which even the world itself admits are wrong. Then Christ is offered as something added, a friend up there, a guarantor against the time when the tumult and the shouting dies and we are called in from the playground and forced to go to sleep. Be it remembered that the great essential facts have not changed. Men are still what they were, and the Son of Man is forever who and what he was. He calls to the eternal in us. Deep calls unto deep. And the call, if it is heard at all, is heard by that in us which is neither savage nor civilized, old nor young, Western nor Oriental, but simply human and once made in the image of God. Now, that doesn't speak directly to our subject tonight, but that concept of childishness, the immaturity that he describes and talks about, you know, and again, sort of a sarcastic way of being called in from the playground and forced to go to sleep after we get all our little games over with. I think Christianity at large is really in that condition. It's difficult to find anybody that you can really discuss anything deep with. And I don't claim to be deep, but I think I have an idea of the difference between deep and shallow. And there's a lot of people that don't even get it. Again, something that I read to you in the teachers' meeting too, about gifts and so forth, how many people are gifted, and many are blessed by the expression of those gifts, but those same gifted people are, when you get to know them, are sometimes so full of self that it's astonishing, the degree of self-service and self-love and self-adoration that goes on. And, you know, what is the cure for that? What's the remedy to our self-obsession? And like it or not, it's chastisement. Peter Kreeft, who's a up-and-coming Christian apologist, pointed out in a book called Making Sense Out of Suffering, he said this. He said, science fiction is modern man's new mythic literature. I didn't need him to tell me that. I kind of figured that out myself. It's because the many of the same themes and the same kind of images appear in science fiction, whether it's ancient mythology or modern mythology. It's all very, there's a real continuity there. Someone asked, Patrick Stewart, who was trained as a Shakespearean actor. They asked Patrick Stewart once, I don't remember what the context was, an article I read, an interview, but they said, you know, you're trained as a Shakespearean actor. Did you find a real gulf between that and portraying the captain of a starship? And he said, no, as a matter of fact, he said the genres are very similar. He said, really, to go from Hamlet or Macbeth or Midsummer Night's Dream, or he said, really, he said there's a whole lot more in common than there is different between the two genres in literature. And of course, one is more visual, but again, the themes are the same, and the scope of it, the size, the dimension of the themes are so universal. And one of the big themes that you'll see in science fiction is the anti-utopian theme. You want to give it a label. But it's either some kind of a traveler, you know, they're explorers, or maybe they're time travelers. But they wind up, if they're time travelers, then it's always our own future. It's always Earth sometime out there in 25th, 6th, 7th, or 8th century, whatever. But they wind up in some place where apparently everything's been fixed. I mean, there's no more disease. There's no more poverty. There's no more hunger. Everybody has a place to live. Everybody's equally cared for. But the visitors, the travelers, sense that there's something being concealed, something under the surface. There's something just not quite right about the situation. And whether that's Odysseus landing on some island, or whether, again, that's the Enterprise landing on, or, you know, beaming down to some planet, the theme is still the same. And that is that there's no such thing as a utopia. And really what it comes down to is a world without suffering, without any suffering at all, is really more like hell than it is like heaven. Now, when we get to heaven, we're not going to suffer. But it's going to be we're on another plane of existence. But living at this on this plane of existence in these bodies, these tactile bodies with six senses, and bound by space and time the way we are, a world without suffering is an anomaly. And there's something sinister and dangerous about it. And always, the theme always, you know, the storyline always winds up with the explorers finding and discovering what it was that was really being concealed the whole time. And sure, there's some cost to pay. You know, everybody doesn't live for 900 years anymore, but they get to enjoy the 100 that they get, or 70 or 80 or whatever it is. You know, instead of being slaves and automatons or worker drones for the thinghood of the universal political institution that directs every affair of their lives. And so, in a sense, suffering is a natural fact of life, is what I'm trying to get at. And again, whether we're dealing with ancient or modern mythologies, we understand that to escape suffering is not something that is even legitimate. Outside of this world, yes. But within the context of our natural lives, we can't even accept as legitimate a life without some amount of suffering in it. And God, C.S. Lewis said, God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pain. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. Again, I don't agree with all C.S. Lewis's theology, but when he was right, he had a good way of saying things. And probably because pain gives us a greater ability to hear God speaking, I imagine it's also God's megaphone to a sleeping or a sluggish Christian, and to a sleeping or a sluggish church, or sleeping or sluggish generation of Christians. And so in verse 4, you have this explanation of chastening. You've not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. If I could paraphrase that, you could say, you got a long way to go. I use the word you editorially, you, me, everybody. We got a long way to go from the standpoint of this writer. And last time we talked about it, you know, I said, certainly the writer has martyrdom in view, but he has more than martyrdom in view. And he just talked about running a race, so we talked about ways that runners can bleed. And again, you know, if all you are is a runner, and you only bleed the way runners bleed, it ain't that bad. It really isn't. The kind of cuts and things that a runner gets to make him bleed, they might be uncomfortable for a while, but most of the time you can finish the race with the kind of bleeding that runners do. Unless you have an aneurysm burst or, you know, a heart vessel explode or something like that. But we're not, that's the abnormal, that's not the normal. And so I think in that context, he's telling us, you haven't run very hard yet. And no, we're certainly not martyrs. But again, the bigger idea is, you know, you're not trying as hard as you ought to be trying. Or you're not going at it with the zeal you ought to be going at it. And again, I don't mean to say that that Christianity is based on trying harder to do better. Again, it's all done by the finished work of Christ. But, you know, after spending some time with Brother Gipp yesterday, again, it reminds me just, you know, sometimes the time that I allow to fritter away. And here's a guy who, in spite of tremendous pain, has committed himself to producing a certain amount of work. He sets goals, and he's, you know, I want to do this, I want to accomplish this. He wants to make some kind of a mark before he's gone. He's already made one, and he is somebody who could sit back and say, well, I've done everything I can do, and nobody would fault him for not trying to get anything else accomplished. But he said, I can't get this done within 3 years. It'll take me at least 3 years to get it done. He said, he said, I don't know if I'll even be able to. You know, under the best circumstances, he said, I really got to get this, I want this project done. And he said, there's a couple of people I thought of that I wanted to help me. And the first two people he thought of were Gail Ripplinger and me, which kind of is, that's exciting to me, but at the same time, it's kind of humbling to me as well. But he wants me to do stuff on apologetics and philosophy for 12th graders going into college. And he said, watch the vocabulary, you're going to have to bring it down. I do understand that, you know, the hard part isn't the concepts. The hard part is putting the concepts in terms that a 12th grader can get them, what a 12th grader can get these days. And but there's the explanation of chastening. Why do we get chastened? Because we're not going as fast as we should, as hard as we should, as long as we should. We quit for so little. And you would think, you know, that quitting would make, or chastening would make us want to quit, but it's somehow it doesn't make you want to quit if you're put together right. And spiritually, if you're put together right, chastening doesn't make you want to quit. Chastening makes you want to go on. Now, if you're put together wrong, a little bit of trouble is all it takes to stop you. If you're put together halfway decent, a lot of trouble is what it takes to stop you. If you're really put together like Gipps put together, the more trouble you have, the more determined you are to keep going. And I really think that that's what a Christian's supposed to be in terms of trying to get something done, making a mark in the world for Jesus before he leaves. And so the next thing in verse number 5, and here's the word, exhortation's right there for you. And ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children, my son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. Again, let me paraphrase that. Don't be surprised or upset when God drives you ahead. And again, it's chastening that drives us ahead. I'll say more about that later. But the idea here is the exhortation. You've forgotten the exhortation. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord. Now, that's a citation from Proverbs 11, or rather Proverbs chapter 3, verse 11 and 12. If you've got a reference Bible, you probably saw that note too. But go ahead and look at Proverbs 3 with me. Proverbs 3, verse 11. My son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, neither be weary of his correction. For whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth, even as the father the son in whom he delighteth. Almost exact. It's a citation or an allusion to, but it's almost a direct quotation of the passage. Certainly got the intent. Don't despise God's chastening. Don't be weary when God chastens you. Now, a couple of things I think we can can't reduce some of these ideas to outlines, but we can give you some headings to put the thoughts under. Take it soberly. In other words, it's a serious business. You know, this is from God. You've forgotten the exhortation of speaking unto you as unto children. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord. I don't imagine that any of us in here, I don't imagine any of us have ever chastened any of our children to the point of bloodshed. Anybody here want to admit that? Yeah. But you know, God sometimes chastens his children to the point of bloodshed. Now, we're so intimidated by the DCFS, you know, and all the do-gooders meddling sob sisters down in the child welfare system, we're afraid court's going to swoop down on us, take our kids away and put them in a foster home someplace, and we'll never ever see them again. We'll be, you know, wandering around in orange jumpsuits if we dare apply the rod. But I'll just say this, scripturally, you know, I know this all goes on tape and I don't want to wind up in orange jumpsuit either, but scripturally, I would have to say that all of us err in the direction of leniency rather than in harshness when it comes to the severity of the discipline that our children probably deserve and need. We probably are way short. Now, I didn't say go home and beat your kids till the smoke alarm goes off. You know, you haven't spanked them right until you've drawn blood. But you probably ought to get closer to drawing blood than you're getting. Just a couple little swats, don't even leave a red mark, probably aren't going to get the job done. And right here, it would be easy to launch into another series on child rearing, you know. But I'll resist that temptation and just go on with talking about what the Lord does here. But he is our model. Again, don't despise the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him, for whom the Lord loveth. So take it solemnly, and then take it sensibly. I mean, be sensible about this. Don't be emotional. Don't just get all caught up in your feelings and what you think is fair and what you feel is right. You remember back in chapter 2 that Christ learned obedience through suffering as a son. Back in Hebrews chapter 2, we're told that. Now, if Christ had learned through suffering, do you really think we're going to catch on very well without any? I don't think we're going to catch on very well without any. I haven't suffered in a long time. I'm not looking forward to the next time I do. I mean that. I'm not looking forward to the next time I do. Some of you don't think I've ever suffered because you haven't known me as long enough. And some of you don't want to remember that you have in the time that you know me. But I have. You didn't know me when I went through a couple of surgeries. You didn't know me when God was breaking me. Some of you maybe remember when I had the chicken pox, carrying 104, 105 temperature for about 4 or 5 days. It took me several years to get my immune system back working right after that dilemma. You know, and I think it's some of that's suffering. But I could suffer a whole lot worse than I have. What I've gone through, I guess it sure felt like suffering when I was going through it. It was suffering to me, you know, kind of like puppy love, right? So are they in love? Well, sure, it's all the love that they know, right? I mean, a couple of 13-year-olds, you know, just, I love him forever. He's the one for me, you know. And so is it real? Yeah, it's real. It's just nothing compared to the real thing or what you get later on. But it's the strongest that they've ever felt. Yeah, I think I know something about it. I know a great deal about it. But I know that the times that I've gotten to know the most about the Lord and the most about myself were the times where I was going through the hardest times. And I like to think that, you know, if you learn that, then that stays with you and you go into easier times and you're a changed person in easier times rather than going back to the same idiot that you were before you went through the hard times. You know, that'd be the hard thing, wouldn't it? You know, God puts you through something to teach you, you know, and then you learn it and then God says, well, look, I think I can bless you in some ways now. And then he blesses you, and then you forget all that stuff, and you go back to being the same stupid idiot you were before, and then God has to put you all through it again. And then some people, you know, it's worse than that. Some people don't ever learn. Just keep going through it and going through it and going through it. And just because someone's going through it doesn't mean that they haven't learned something. It may mean God's got something special for them. Take it sensibly. Now, that's almost a contradiction, because sometimes it don't make sense. It doesn't always make sense why this person's going through that, and you're going through this, and they're not, someone else isn't going through anything at all. You're never going to be able to figure it out. But the sensible thing to think about your own suffering, 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse number 8. 2 Timothy 1, verse number 8. Be not therefore ashamed of the testimony of our Lord, nor of me his prisoner, but be thou partaker of the afflictions of the gospel according to the power of God. And anybody with any sense would know that that verse must have something to say to all of us. The sensible way of looking at suffering is that you're probably going to have some. Don't be ashamed of being a partaker of the afflictions of the gospel according to the power of God. And we are afflicted so that we can be used by God to spread the gospel with his power. If you're going to be used of God just to preach the gospel, spread the gospel, give the gospel with any power, then some suffering is going to have to come and pass. Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, verse 11. Matthew 5, verse number 11. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. Again, a sensible person reading that would understand that people are going to say bad things about you, and that hurts. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names can hurt me too. Sure. And a spirit of a man shall sustain his infirmity, but a wounded spirit, who can bear it? You know, and sometimes people lying about you and thinking wrong about you and misunderstanding your motives and all that, and, you know, all that, that hurts. It hurts. I mean, if you're going to go into ministry, you better get a thick enough skin and not let it continue to hurt. You just, ooh, that's smarted, and then you forget it. You know, you just let it go. You can't hang on to it and be used to God. It doesn't, I didn't say it didn't hurt when you first hear it, but you learn how to just not think about it anymore. Just say, oh, Lord, thank you for that. Praise the Lord. And go on and think about something else. And do something else. But you don't stew in it. You don't lick it and keep it open and fester on it and just console yourself in your self-pity. It ain't that big of a deal. Again, fellow once went to, I remember Dr. Upman telling a story. I don't think it was him. I think it was probably J. Frank Norris or Sam Jones or somebody like that he told the story about. But anyway, some woman went up to this preacher and said, you know, so-and-so, if you knew what I knew about the pastor's church, you wouldn't preach for him. And he said, lady, if I knew what God knows about you, I'd puke. You know? So, yeah, it kind of comes down to that. You know, if I figure, you know, whatever they say about me isn't probably as bad as the truth. So what do I have to be upset about? John 16, verse number 33, though. These things I've spoken unto you, that in me you might have peace, in the world you shall have tribulation. So think of it sensibly. A sensible person would take Jesus at his word. Now again, you can't make sense out of what happens in everybody's life compared to your life. But like I said Sunday morning, the most offensive doctrine in the Bible to the natural, the carnal mind is the sovereignty of God. And I don't preach the sovereignty of God as an arbitrary thing in the matter of salvation, where some are foreordained to go to hell and they couldn't be saved no matter how badly they wanted to. God, listen, it's real simple. God sovereignly decided to give you a free will. It's a simple, you know, if God is so sovereign that, you know, that these ultra-predestinarians say he is, and can do anything he pleases and the whole world's controlled by him, then he can say, my sovereign decision is to let you decide. What's so difficult? I don't understand what's so difficult about that conceptually. You say, you know, well, then that thwarts. No, it's not. Doesn't thwart the will of God, because God left it up to you. Right? I say, well, you know, but it says he's not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. Well, yeah, then he's willing for you to get saved. But he's, you know, in other words, he didn't will for you to go to hell. He's willing for you to get saved. But if you want to go to hell, he'll let you go to hell. But he sovereignly decided to give you a free will in the matter. He sovereignly decided to leave the decision to you. And that in no way ever is an effrontery to his sovereignty. But anyway, Christ had to learn through suffering. So sensibly, we're going to have to learn through suffering. Christ promised that we'd have tribulation, so a sensible person would recognize that when tribulation happens, it's the thing we should have been expecting. Now, there's several wrong responses to God's chastisement, and I'm not going to try and give you all of them, because the writer of Hebrews doesn't bother to do that in the context, so why should I run all over the Bible to give you ones he didn't bother to include, but he did give us two. In verse number 5, you've forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as children, my son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. Despising and fainting are the two things that the writer of Hebrews gives us. They're wrong responses to chastisement. Getting bitter is another one. I heard a guy say something yesterday morning. A preacher said, he said, bitterness does far more to damage the vessel in which it is stored than which it is poured. That's worth writing down. I got my pen out. I didn't write anything else down, he said, but I wrote that down. It's in the front of my Bible. There's a few things, you know. I don't take preachers' outlines down anymore. Most of mine are better than theirs. Every now and then, after about the third point, I think, boy, that's good. I better get that down. I can't come up with one better than that. But usually mine are better. I'm not bragging. I really am not bragging. I'm pretty good at outlining. So I don't. But you know how I learned how to outline? Taking down other preachers' outlines. Before I learned how, I took theirs down. Believe me, I wrote everybody's outline down. I said, how'd they come up with that? And now I've developed the ability to do it pretty well. But I wrote that. Now I listen for some truth, and I get that truth, and that's what I usually think about. If I don't like the preacher's message, I'll usually focus in on something he said and kind of work on that for the rest of the time. But anyway, bitterness does more to damage the vessel in which it is stored than the object on which it is poured. That'll stay with you for a while if you can get that one. Now, despise it. To despise is to hold in contempt, scorn, disdain, to have a low opinion. And to faint, as an intransitive verb, which is the way it's used there, to lose strength and color, become senseless, motionless, to swoon, to become feeble or decline or fail in strength and vigor, to be weak, to sink into dejection, to lose courage or spirit, to decay, to disappear, to vanish. They just kind of fainted, you know. Faded away. And at first, you know, they're not there on Wednesday. They're not there on Sunday night. They're not there on Sunday school. They're not there on Sunday morning. Then they're not there. They just kind of faded away, you know. Faint when thou art rebuked of him. So, well, why'd they stop? Because God did something they didn't like. And they didn't think about it sensibly. They thought about it emotionally. They didn't read the Bible and know what the Bible said to expect these kinds of things. And so when they happened, they weren't prepared for them. And take it spiritually, verse number 6. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. And being a son of God is a spiritual thing, by the way. And God is, you know, we've got this idea, you know, from movies and television programs and romantic novels out of the 19th century. You know, this brutal, sadistic headmaster who, you know, calls some boy up to the front of the one-room schoolhouse and bends him over the stool and just whips the tar out of him, you know, until the schoolmaster's so exhausted he can't hardly breathe. I had a friend, his dad worked for NSA. And Brother Wataziak worked there too. But sometimes he'd get in trouble. And his dad, he'd put him in the bathroom and he'd make him put his arms inside the bathtub. And it's kind of funny anyway. We'd have him lay over the edge of the bathtub with his arms in the bathtub and his knees on the outside. And then he'd take his belt off. But the first thing he'd do is he'd come home. And it was like in the hot weather. He only had one air conditioner. It was in the bedroom. You know, and he'd go home, he'd turn the air conditioner on in the bedroom. And about the time the bedroom cooled down, he'd make John go wait in the bathroom, you know, laying over the edge of the bathtub. And John would stay in there until the bedroom cooled down. And then his dad would start whipping him. And he'd whip him until he was wore out. Then he'd go lay in the bed in the bedroom with the air conditioner on until he cooled off and go back in and do it again. Three or four times. And you know, it didn't straighten that kid out. He was just as wild and just as crazy and just as troublesome. As, I don't know what was wrong with him, but he was put together weird. I think that would have got me to stop. And it wasn't like a daily routine, you know, but when he had it coming, man, I mean, his dad couldn't beat him long enough to straighten him out without going in and laying down and cooling off in the bedroom, and he'd come back and do it again. The kid still had an unbelievably stubborn heart. But anyway, you know, we have this idea, this, you know, brutal, sadistic kind of a beating. And that, you know, it borders on brutal and sadistic, but I don't know what, you know what took, I'll tell you what took it. You know what straightened him out? I'll tell you what straightened him out. I'm not lying to you. He took a 68 Camaro and ran the telephone pole with it and got caught underneath the engine, and they had to pry him out of there, and he was in a body cast for about a year. I mean, just, you know, he had his arms, but his chest and his legs and everything else. He's laying in a hospital bed in a body cast for the greater part of a year. And after that, he got right with the Lord and went to Bible college. He said, now, I don't know what's wrong with a head like that, you know. He said, but I don't know what was wrong with his, I don't know if his dad was doing anything wrong. I honestly don't know if his dad was doing anything wrong, because somehow he wasn't submitting to that, so that's what it took. Anyway, Satan wants you to think that God's chastisement is something sadistic and brutal, but he's a liar. Remember that. He wants you to think that if you're suffering, that's a sign that God doesn't love you. But remember, he's a liar. And God says it is a sign that he loves you. Whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. And if you don't have any chastisement, you're a bastard. And it's not a sign of parental love to withhold correction when it's needed. It's a sign of parental love to give it when it's needed. And verse number 7 and 8, then you have an expectation concerning chastening. If ye endure chastening, God deal with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? But if ye be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, and are ye bastards and not sons. And so, if I could paraphrase that, know that chastening is what separates the sons from the sinners. Being a son and being chastened to the Father go hand in hand. There isn't one without the other. And again, God disciplines because he loves. And suffering at God's hands isn't misery, and it's not a mistake, and it's not the work of the devil. It's a sign of God's love. It's his discipline. Chastening is not judgment. The word there, chasteneth, it means to correct, to train, to instruct, to bring up. And scourging. Now, scourging, that's flogging. I mean, it's a synonym for flogging, with a whip or a cane or something like that. You know, now we've got the idea of the medieval landlord, you know, flogging the serfs just for his own amusement. But again, that's not for God's amusement. That's for our chastisement, for our benefit. And a so-called Christian living a disobedient life without chastisement isn't a Christian. He may have made a profession of faith, but if a person can go on for several years without being chastised, live in sin and not have any chastisement from God, they probably need to be saved. And in an example of and I would venture to say, almost certainly need to be saved, but I couldn't put a yearly figure on that, you know, how long is long enough, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, I really don't know, I honestly don't know, but I would think somebody maybe 10 years, you know, I think that's way on the outside, but I think somebody going on 10 years just living like the devil and not being chasing the Lord almost got to be lost. I'd be suspicious after 5, and I'd begin to question after about 2 or 3. Really, after about 2 or 3, I'm beginning to say, I don't know if they're even saved. And after about 5, I'd be saying, I'm pretty sure they're not. And after 10, I'd say, I'd stake my bank account that they're not. But I can't say for sure. But I, you know, if I knew somebody 2, 3 years, I loved them, and they've been out of the will of God and living like the devil, and God hadn't chasing them, I'd be praying for God chasing them, for them to get saved more. Because they're not going to change without it. An example of chastening, again, verse 9, furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. By the way, if your children don't give you reverence, it's because you don't chasten them. Sorry about that, but they won't revere you if you don't chasten them. And how often people come out with remarks like, well, how can this be good for me? How could God let this happen to me? This isn't fair. Why is this happening to me? Well, I really can't tell you that, but I know God has his reasons, and he doesn't make mistakes. And that may seem kind of insensitive, but what do you tell a person? Oh, you poor thing. You're right. God's made a mistake in your case. But keep loving him. Keep coming to church. Keep reading his word, because obviously even though he doesn't know what he's doing, he still does it. No. I can't talk to people like that. God's obviously made a mistake here, but worship him anyway? No, God can't. If you're going to worship him, you have to accept that he knows what he's doing. And I can pray for you and pray for God to give you strength and grace. And maybe that he'd lighten it a little bit until you're able to handle more, but I know he doesn't make any mistakes. Even the best and the most loving, the most consistent parent can have selfish motives in discipline. Verse 10, for they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure. Again, there's the right reason to chasten your child is for their benefit. But I've always appreciated it when I've had to correct my children and they behaved. I've always liked the result of that. They weren't acting right, and now I chastened them, and now they're acting right. That always kind of, made me happy. I always got something out of that. Did you ever, the peaceable fruit of righteousness? Did you notice that in there? See, where is that? And partakers of his holiness. In verse number 11, it yielded the peaceable fruit of righteousness. Did you ever notice how peaceful it gets around your house after somebody gets disciplined? I mean, the whole crowd, they all be acting up. Everybody's just frazzled nerves and everybody getting on everybody else's and just edgy. And then somebody gets it, and then everybody else just quiet, Peaceable fruit of righteousness. You want a calm, quiet, peaceful house? Just pick one and let them have it. And the rest of them will settle down. But I've had selfish motives in discipline, but I believe discipline for the good of my children, principally, and my own benefit after that. But God only has our good in mind. And the worst thing that could happen to a Christian, I think, would be to stop fearing God. And the objective of our chastening and our scourging is the product of God-like character in us. I mean, the peaceable fruit of righteousness. That's why he does that. And if we can't respect a parent who doesn't chasten us, how can we respect the God who doesn't chasten us? And isn't holiness the greatest need in the church today? I would have to say, man, holiness is so far out of our minds even. And the eventuality of chastening comes in verse 13 or 11 through 13. Now chastening for the present, no chastening for the present seemed to be joyous but grievous. I don't ever remember thinking with joyful enthusiasm, boy, am I ever going to get it when Dad gets home. I just can't wait. The belt is going to wail tonight. I remember thinking the belt's going to wail, but I don't ever remember thinking about it with any kind of eagerness or excitement. Just can't wait till Dad gets home. For that. I'm sure John Garner didn't think that way. That's the guy who was getting off and over the bathtub. By the way, he's got Peter Harrison, one of Peter Harrison's best friends, is John Garner's son. Same guy who I was telling you about, his dad whipped him over the bathtub. But by the way, there's the word exercise is in there. Them that are exercised thereby. You ever notice what good exercise it is to get a whipping? I can remember being exhausted after him. So what do you? You'd be strong. Exercise makes, if you have time to recover and repair, exercise makes you stronger. It tears down, but then your body recovers, repairs. And chastisement tears down, just like exercise, but then you get some reprieve, and you begin to recover, you begin to repair, and you come back stronger. Be strong. No chastening, for the present seem to be joyous, but grievous. Lift up the hands which hang down, the feeble knees. That's that child that's been corrected, but hasn't been set right yet. You know, okay, straighten up. Lift up those, get your, stand upright, get your posture right, chin up, shoulders back, stomach in, and start walking straight. There is in verse 12, lift up the hands which hang down the feeble knees and make straight paths for your feet. Be strong, be straight. It's like the comparison to a walkway that's, been all heaved up and broken over the time and just left in disrepair. And then make those straight paths for your feet. Clean up the path. Make it clear. Make it plain. Make it level. Get all the stumbling blocks out of the way. Make your life a path that others can follow in the way of truth and righteousness. Just like we are running that race, and we have to be careful about what we are as runners, you want to do something about the track too. You want to make sure the course that you're running. And that's one of the things that chastisement does, is it cleans up the course you're running. And then be sanitary. Just had to get 3 points. But lift up the hands that hang down, the feeble knees, make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. Get all the corruption, all that stuff that infects, all that sin, the weights that so easily beset us. It's another reference back to that. Getting all those things out of the way. Getting the corruption out so you can heal, so you can recover your strength, so you can run the race. That's the purpose of chastisement. The purpose of chastisement is so that we'll grow and mature and be disciplined runners in the race that we're called to run, so that we can be godlike, so that we can have the peaceable fruit of righteousness. And, of course, that leads on to other things, but I'm already going pretty long. And did I take as long as I think? I'm looking at 10 till 9, 5 till 9 maybe. Sorry about that. All right, you do have choir rehearsal. Sorry. So why don't you go ahead and have choir rehearsal, and when that's over, you'll go home.